Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. And from Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
On Capitol Report this week, a broader look at the so-called immigrant tuition bill from different groups of people the newly signed legislation into law affects.
It's not just a Latino victory. This is a victory for all Floridians because this is, you know, leveling the playing field when it comes to all of our students that have went to school here, that have spent their lives here.
Also this week, after the governor's funding veto, Florida lawmakers are split on how to pay for legal services for the poor.
We've had to cut back on staff. So we have fewer staff to try to respond to a greater request for services.
We'll also hear about the need for the medically challenged to absolutely have a disaster plan ready, the rocky road to picking a new president at Florida State University, and we'll discover how the Florida Keys are rapidly turning into a tropical paradise for chickens. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Say the words immigration reform, and most people think of all the conflict raging at the federal level of government. This week's primary defeat of U.S. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, in which at least some of the blame for his loss is being pinned on his immigration views, is just one, for instance. But immigration is also a hot topic in Florida. Governor Rick Scott recently signed the so-called immigrant tuition bill into law that would grant in-state tuition rates to undocumented immigrants. Since near the end of session, Scott has been touting the legislation and even did a week-long tour in support of it this week. While it's publicized more as a Hispanic win, Sasha Cordner reports on other segments of the immigrant population who will also be affected by the new law.
Since signing the bill Monday, Governor Scott has been touring the state as part of his college affordability tour, touting the bill that not only prohibits tuition hikes by most colleges and universities without legislative approval, but also grants in-state tuition rates to undocumented immigrants who live in Florida.
I want to make sure every child can afford their education, whatever country you're from, whatever family or zip code. And then once you're finished, I want to make sure that you can get a job.
Scott's latest stance on the immigration tuition issue is different from his 2011 viewpoint. Shortly after taking office, he told the conservative blog Shark Tank he's opposed to the idea.
You know, with regard to giving tuition reduction, in-state tuition to illegal immigrants, I wouldn't be doing that.
Not only did he not say he would never do that, I mean, this is the candidate that ran on saying that the Arizona-style immigration bill was great and we should follow it.
That's Florida Democratic Party Vice Chair Annette Tedeo-Goldstein, who says even with Scott changing his tune years later, Hispanic voters won't forget the past in the upcoming November election.
It's amazing what an election year will do, but so this is a win, and it's a wonderful thing. But at the same time, I don't think Hispanic voters will be fooled by the fact that this is an election year gimmick. We know exactly how he feels about Hispanics. And I'm not speaking just as a Democrat. I think as a Hispanic, we have not forgotten and we will not forget.
Lately, Hispanics have been in the forefront in media reports, on the campaign trail, or when politicians speak about immigration reform in general. And immigration lawyer Elizabeth Ritchie, a partner at her firm Rambana & Ritchie, says it's a common misconception.
People think immigration is specifically a Mexican issue or a Hispanic issue. It is not. It's an issue that involves people from all over the world. We happen to see a lot of Mexicans in the United States because they're our neighbors, just like we see a lot of Canadians on the northern border. So to say that immigration is a Hispanic issue exclusively is just not accurate.
She says at her own law firm, she sees an even mix of immigrants.
It certainly is a lot of Hispanics. It's a lot of Indians, a lot of Chinese, Haitian, and Germans.
And Ritchie says she's even gotten a lot of calls about the bill from a multitude of immigrant groups.
Especially from my Chinese clients. Yes, people are very interested, as I would be, in receiving accurate information so that they can pursue the American dream, including being educated in the United States at a reasonable rate. Even though it's really outside of the scope of what I do, it's related to what I do, so people ask me about it.
Francesca Menez is a Florida Immigration Coalition's policy and advocacy coordinator. She's also part of the Black Immigration Network. She grew up in the community of Little Haiti in Miami and is of Haitian and Dominican descent.
We know for the most part, when it's in the, at least in the media's perspective, they're focusing on the Latino community, particularly because of the fact of the voting bloc that they have and the impact that they have on elections, but not taking into consideration other immigrant communities, just like Asian communities, the Black immigrant communities, the Afro-Caribbean communities, that we also impact elections for the most part in the same ways.
And she says politicians are also contributing to the Hispanic focus as well. Stillman says she also doesn't believe the Black community gets lost in the immigrant tuition issue because many immigrant groups in Florida are making sure to reach out to their respective communities.
Because whenever we, you know, we make sure that we talk to our communities, that we understand that this victory is not just for the immigrant community. It's not just a Latino victory. This is a victory for all Floridians because this is, you know, leveling the playing field when it comes to all of our students that have went to school here, that have spent their lives here. And because of the simple fact that they are not documented in this country, they didn't have the opportunity to pay a fair rate, basically, to go to school here in the state of Florida.
Menez says several different immigrant groups are now working on getting a bill through in 2015 that was vetoed by the governor last year that would have allowed children of undocumented immigrants to get temporary driver's licenses. She adds they hope whoever in the governor's mansion next year will show they are truly committed to the immigrant community as a whole by backing that bill. Meanwhile, the new law will take effect July 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Florida lawyers agree there's a funding crisis that threatens legal services for the poor, but there's disagreement among them on how to fix the problem. As Jessica Palumbo reports, the Florida Bar opposes a proposal by hundreds of attorneys to raise bar membership dues to cover the cost.
For people under a certain income level, legal aid can help with issues spanning from scams to juvenile justice. But in Florida, there's only about one legal aid lawyer for every 20,000 eligible clients, according to state administrators. One of their clients is Tallahassee's Sandra Peavy, who says she's elderly and disabled.
They saved my home and my sanity, tell you the truth.
Peavy says earlier this year, her bank kept calling her and telling her to vacate her house because they were foreclosing on it. But she says she never got a written notice and she couldn't get the bank to take a check from a friend who had offered to help. That's when she went to Legal Services of North Florida, one of the state's 30 legal aid offices.
If it wasn't for them, I would be out of my house. Not only me, what about the other people that don't work or sick or elderly and need legal assistance and they can't afford it? I mean, they're going to lose everything they have. I almost lost everything if it wasn't for legal aid, and that is the God heaven truth.
But the office's executive director, Chris Nabb, says people who depend on legal aid are having an increasingly hard time getting services as funding sources have dried up over the past decade. The most recent blow, she says, was when Governor Rick Scott vetoed all $2 million the legislature had given in state funding this year.
The purpose of that was to help people who were domestic violence victims, elderly citizens and children, people who were disabled, who were seeking public benefits, federal public benefits. I mean, it's hard to see how any of that would be controversial.
She says 4 years of vetoes have been compounded by another shrinking money pool that depends on interest rates and real estate transactions, both of which dropped off during the recession. Florida Legal Services Executive Director Kent Spooler says that combination has decimated local offices that theoretically must serve all 7 million eligible Floridians.
We've lost probably 100 legal aid lawyers, and we only started out with 486.
So Spooler and hundreds of other attorneys, former Supreme Court justices and Florida bar presidents among them, have a plan. Get the Florida Supreme Court to raise bar membership dues by $100 for an annual legal aid cash influx of $10 million.
If you have a responsibility to the public, you are, quote, the guardians of the rule of law, and you don't have rule of law if there's huge segments of our population that don't have any access.
But the more than 50 attorneys elected to serve on the Florida Bar Board of Governors have unanimously voted to oppose the fee hike. For one reason, Bar President Eugene Pettis says private attorneys already donate millions of hours of pro bono legal help on top of millions in cash donations to the cause.
It is not just a legal crisis. It's a societal crisis. And we do not look to any one sector of our society to resolve its own problems singularly.
He says the bar believes the legal aid system, not just in Florida but across the nation, is in need of a major efficiency overhaul. On the federal level, he says agencies are working to make benefits information and customer service more accessible. But for people who need legal aid lawyers to navigate pressing issues, he says support must come from a wide variety of sources, including the business sector.
Most of these issues are issues that affect people's personal effectiveness within the workplace, for those that are fortunate to have jobs. Thus, the business community, the corporate community, needs to be at the table.
Pettis says he looks forward to continuing the discussion this fall at a planned Access to Justice Summit to be held by future Florida Supreme Court Chief Justice Jorge Labarga. He says State Attorney General Pam Bondi and legal services lawyers have also confirmed they'll attend. Meanwhile, he says the bar has agreed to loan $6 million to the legal aid funding pot over the next 2 years. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Still to come on Capitol Report, medical marijuana opponents ramp up their anti-pot campaign in advance of this November's ballot initiative.
Our folks that are pushing this position tell you it's medicine for the very sick. When's the last time you went to the doctor and they gave you some medicine and said, smoke this till you feel better?
The long and winding road to pick a new president for Florida State University gets longer and windier.
It's always been our mission is to have an open, honest, thorough, transparent process to select the next president of Florida State.
Having a hurricane plan is always critical in Florida, but we'll find out how even more important it is for those who have special medical needs. And we'll visit the Florida Keys, where it seems too many chickens are coming home to roost. According to recent polls, a plan to allow medical marijuana in Florida enjoys strong support among the state's voters. Opponents of the proposed amendment to the state constitution are ramping up their rhetoric, but as Nick Evans reports, at least one person, who used to be the state's attorney general, thinks the claims coming from organizations like Don't Let Florida Go to Pot may be a bit overblown.
Polk County Sheriff and President of the Florida Sheriff's Association, Grady Judd, is throwing his weight behind the Don't Let Florida Go to Pot campaign. Judd says he opposes Amendment 2, which would make medical marijuana legal in the state, because he's skeptical of the amendment's aims.
Amendment 2 is about legalization of marijuana. This is not about the medical use of marijuana. It's about legalization of marijuana. And this amendment, in fact, is a wolf in sheep's clothing.
But supporters say Judd's statement isn't supported by the text of the amendment. In order to get the drug, the proposal specifies a person must have a debilitating medical condition. Opponents focus on the amendment's definition of that term. It lists a series of diseases like cancer and AIDS, but it also allows doctors to designate other conditions. Judd worries that language could allow Floridians to get marijuana for something as trivial as a broken arm. But this reading is incomplete. The proposal says to recommend the drug, a doctor must believe use of marijuana would outweigh the potential health risks for a patient. Drug-Free America Executive Director Kelvina Fay is also concerned medical marijuana could lead to a resurgence of fly-by-night doctors offering recommendations for bogus complaints.
If you just look at the history of what we've gone through with pill mills, you can imagine that it would be the same type of doctors making those recommendations.
Judd echoes these fears and says Amendment 2 could lead to children getting drugs without their parents' knowledge.
So you go to one of your pot docs, which used to be your pill doc till we put them out of business, and they have no civil or criminal liability, and they say, kid, you really could use some of this stuff, and they provide it for you.
But the amendment explicitly calls for the Florida Department of Health to issue reasonable regulations necessary for the implementation and enforcement of the amendment. The group United for Care ran the petition campaign to get Amendment 2 on the ballot this November, when voters will have a final say on the issue. Director Ben Pallera says Judd's arguments show little faith in the government's ability to construct regulations.
His core argument presupposes that the state will implement this in an irresponsible way, which I don't think is the case. I mean, we left a lot of the implementation up to the state so that they could specifically do what is best for the state of Florida rather than having, very strict set of guidelines kind of shoved down their throat. We left it open to the state to figure out how best to regulate this.
In response to Judd's claims about children getting marijuana behind their parents' backs, Pallera is very direct.
Yeah, it's simply false. It is Florida law. It is the law of the land across the country that you cannot provide non-emergency medical treatment to a minor without parental consent, except for very, very narrow circumstances.
And Pallera says Judd's claim Amendment 2 will legalize marijuana for purposes other than medical reasons doesn't give Florida voters enough credit.
It's basically a statement from him that, you know, he thinks the electorate of Florida are, are sheep and are being tricked by something that is very plainly a medical marijuana amendment.
But Judd, Fay, and Pallera are deeply invested in the issue. What about someone on the outside looking in? Former Attorney General and former Sheriff Bob Butterworth says he supports the amendment but understands its opponents' fears.
Sheriff Judd's a very good friend, and he's a great sheriff. And he should be concerned where he is. Like I said, if I was still a sheriff, I may very well be on that side of the table to make sure that it does not mean legalization of marijuana.
Butterworth says he doesn't think the amendment will lead to out-and-out legalization, but there's a wild card that no one is talking about. Every 20 years, Florida has a Constitutional Revision Commission that is charged with reviewing the Constitution and proposing changes to the electorate. The last commission met 17 years ago, and Butterworth was a member.
If, in fact, this goes the wrong way, the Revision Commission definitely has the authority to go forward and put something on the ballot to correct something that they think is inappropriate.
The next revision commission begins meeting in just 3 years, so even if Amendment 2 passes, it will face review almost immediately. But with 4 months left before Floridians head to the polls, the rhetoric is likely to get worse before it gets better. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
After what some critics have called a rigged start, Florida State University officials have made an about-face in an effort to redefine the kind of leader they're seeking to head the university. Regan McCarthy reports the change comes after a public outcry from the school's faculty and students.
When Florida State University's presidential search first started getting attention from news organizations, it was because lawmaking heavyweight Republican Senator John Thrasher appeared to have skipped some steps and become heir apparent for the job. Tallahassee Democratic Representative Michelle Raywinkle Vasalenda says it's that perception that made her throw her own hat in the ring.
I felt it was very concerning that it appeared that he was going to be the only one interviewed and there was going to be an up or down vote to put his name forward to the Board of Trustees.
And Raywinkle Vasalenda isn't the only person concerned about the issue. Earlier this month, a group of faculty held a no-confidence vote against the firm FSU officials had hired to find a new president, which led to the company's headhunter stepping down and the FSU search committee announcing plans to hire a new search firm.
We have to look at where we are and take stock of where we are today. Our mission has been very clear from the beginning. We have stated it many times. It's to conduct an open, thorough, and honest search to find the very best president we can to lead Florida State University.
That's Florida State Board of Trustees member Ed Burr. He's heading up the university's presidential search efforts. Burr says the committee has reset to ensure that more open process. As part of that, the committee has backed down from a plan to interview only Senator Thrasher. The lawmaker will be included in the pool for consideration, but many feel his chances have dimmed. Former student government member Sean Cooley, who spoke at the search committee's most recent meeting, says he hopes that change will include renewed focus on a president with an academic rather than just political background.
I can't imagine working with a president or a provost or anyone at the university in a high up position that does not have academic credentials. Working with then-Provost Stokes and President Barron on some quality enhancement plan issues and committees for our own campus in Panama City, having a strong academic background for them was essential.
Other members of the public who attended the meeting advocated for a timeline for submitting applications and picking a new president, and they hoped members of the student body, faculty, and community would have a growing voice in the ongoing process. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
If you've heard it once, you probably heard it hundreds of times from Florida emergency people. Get a plan. Of course, they're talking about knowing what you need to do, where you need to go, and lots of other considerations in the event of something terrible like a hurricane. But for those who have special medical needs, that advanced preparation becomes even more critical. From registering for special needs shelters to early prescription refills, Lottie Watts with member station WUSF in Tampa takes a look at how people with medical needs get ready for the storms to come.
Dr. Theo Tsai is a chief medical officer for health insurance company Humana. He's also lived through several hurricanes.
I remember the worst one for me was in the Bahamas, where I was on the first floor, and it was a pretty bad hurricane, and Nassau typically floods a lot.
When he offers advice on preparing for hurricanes, it comes from his own experience.
Being there alone in the apartment by myself and basically not having access to anything, I mean, it kind of brings home the point that it is important to prepare. I mean, something as simple as water. Thank God I had a gallon of water there, but if that storm had lasted a little bit longer, I don't know what I would have done.
It took that storm to get him to do things differently.
I used to say, why do people rush to the supermarkets when there's a storm coming? But after that, I used to be the first person in line.
Tsai is in charge of Humana's senior products in Central Florida. He says for people with chronic medical conditions, getting everything ready also means figuring out what to do if you have medical devices that you need to plug in or medications you need to keep cold.
If you stay at home and there is a loss of electricity, your refrigerator obviously cannot keep the temperatures that are required to make sure that your medication doesn't go to waste.
Since power outages can impact ventilators and other devices, Dr. Tsai recommends evacuating out of the area with friends or family or registering for your county's special needs shelter. Keely Smith is the special needs shelter coordinator for Hillsborough County. Smith says people need to register in advance for the shelters.
Individuals would have to meet certain medical criteria in order to register. That would be individuals that require maybe assistance with medications, that are on electrically dependent equipment for their medical conditions, individuals on oxygen, or individuals that require daily assistance from nursing personnel.
As part of any evacuation plan, whether you're going to a shelter or elsewhere, you need to make sure you bring your medications with you. Sylvia Smith of Disability Rights Florida says a state law passed in 2006 allows for early prescription refills under certain emergency circumstances.
If your county is under a hurricane warning or is part of a state of emergency in Florida by executive order of the governor, or your county has activated its emergency operations center, the insurance companies are required by Florida law to remove any barrier to you receiving an early refill for your medication.
Smith says that because of this law, her organization no longer gets complaints from people who say they had trouble getting an early prescription refill to put in their hurricane emergency kit. I'm Lottie Watts in Tampa.
You're listening to Capital Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, when it comes to a wide and sometimes exotic assortment of flora and fauna, the Florida Keys has few competitors. In fact, some of the most exotic fauna is frequently of the human variety. That species probably won't disappear anytime soon, but there are some other kinds of Keys wildlife that really are endangered. In recent years, there's been a growing push to protect native animals while repelling the invaders that could harm the natural balance. As Lynn Hatter discovered during her recent trip to Key West, not all of the invading species can be called exotic.
There's a really corny joke that starts with, why did the chicken cross the road? Well, in Key West, the chickens are always crossing the road or hanging out by the local bars. They also love to chill out by the beach, where Patty Shanafelt runs a business renting lounge chairs and umbrellas to beachgoers.
Just like people think birds carry a lot of diseases, we carry more diseases than the birds do. People forget we are also animals and we carry tons of diseases.
Shanafelt has just finished feeding a mother hen and her chicks, which walked up to her booth. But Shanafelt says, don't be mistaken, not everyone in Key West is fond of the feisty fowl. As we discuss the Key West chickens, a man in black swim trunks walks up. He doesn't want to give his name, but tells a similar story of chickens in Hawaii with a more morbid outcome.
Rampant, like roosters, big cocks.
Mm-hmm.
So are people.
And you can just grab them, and if they're on your property, you can grab them just really, and that's it. Because they're
But we don't want to hear about that.
So rampant. You know what happened when the hurricane came? All the chickens were gone because it blew them all away.
In a place where invasive species like iguanas abound, the most common of all, the chicken draws a lot of ire. They crow at all hours of the day and night. And they strut the street like they own it. While they don't get any special protections in the Keys, residents cannot shoot them and cruelty laws are enforced. In case anyone is wondering, these are wild, feral chickens and they don't make a good dinner. Tom Sweets, executive director of the Florida Wildlife Center, points out the chickens don't have many natural predators.
We get hawks twice a year migrating through, but they don't really get the numbers down. Now, this being Key West, you'll hear a lot of different stories about how the chickens got here, mm-hmm. but it's sort of a combination of everything.
The Wildlife Center caters to birds with a mission to rehabilitate and release injured animals, including ones considered invasive. The chickens came to the Keys in waves, from early settlers who used them as a food source to the people who used to work in the old cigar factories. The Wildlife Center has a deal with the city of Key West to relocate the chickens to new homes elsewhere. While some consider them pests, Peggy Kuntz, the center's animal care director, says they've become a big hit with farmers and ranchers.
What a Key West chicken does better than any animal on the planet is pest control. And with the desire to be organic growing in popularity, everyone is looking for new ways to keep their bug population down that is effective and cheap. And we have a bunch of very, very willing volunteers.
At one point, about 10% of the city's entire population were chickens, and they're an island icon. But they also poop, leading to concerns about the quality of the water and the beaches. Furthermore, the chicken population is spreading up the Keys, leading to concerns they could crowd out some of the last native species of the Florida Keys. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Nick Evans, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. And from Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.